Hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus. We're streaming live on the web at kuci.org. Today is Wednesday, December 5th, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and before I bring on our guest, I want to tell you, if you want to hear this show again or listen to other shows, we have hundreds that we've podcast. Go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, and there you will have access to all the shows that we have done thus far over 20 years, kind of a long time. In any case, today, my guest for the entire hour is literary agent Betsy Amster. Before opening her agency, Betsy spent 10 years as an editor at Pantheon and Vintage, and 2 years as editorial director of Globe Pequot Press. She's been a Los Angeles agent for something like, I want to say 2 decades, but she'll get us clear on that one, and with a brief stint in Portland, and we're very glad she's back in LA. Betsy Amster. Hello. Betsy? Well, she was here, and now she doesn't seem to be. I don't know where she went. Betsy? I am going to put on another song, and we will get her back, so don't go anywhere.
Give me what you can. I'm a girl who depends on just a little love to help me make it through cold and weary nights, just enough to take away the tough part of living. Can't you see I'm willing to let it off, try letting it all off, making fun where none had been before. Let it off,
Okay, I think we have her back. Betsy?
I am here.
There you are. I'm so glad. I did an introduction.
That is wonderful. Thank you so much.
And now we're on the air. So let's start with, and you've been on the show a couple of times, and I was trying to think of obvious changes in publishing since you were on last. And before we get to that, for those brand new to the show and perhaps new to writing, could you talk briefly about how you see your role as an agent?
My role, I'm going to mix metaphors now.
Go ahead.
I am the midwife. I make it so, I work with an author to realize their best work. And what that means is, when I take an author on, often their material is not ready to go to publishers yet. And I will work with them and polish the material and make sure that it doesn't accidentally set off alarm bells with editors. I really feel that is my special gift, to sort of anticipate where things might make editors anxious, and then decide which houses to go to, and always stay in close touch with my author so that they are aware of what's going on. This is where the mixed metaphor comes in. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like having a whole bunch of garage bands, which I love about it, because you're getting things off the ground that might seem sort of like the gleam in somebody's eye at first, and then you are helping to realize it. Because I know, you know, I mean, agents in general know the people and the processes, and so that helps us get things across.
Do you think editors expect agents to do work before proposals or novels are sent in? I mean, do they hope for that?
They have for years, actually. I remember driving an editor around L.A. from New York a long, long time ago, probably 20 years, and saying to him, Mitchell, I do believe the editorial function is being spun out to agents. And he didn't think that was the case. But I really do feel that, at least at the front end, agents do a great deal of editorial work, and many agents used to be editors.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, when writers say to me, you know, I don't know whether to get an agent because they take 15% or to just do it myself. It's like the 15% is sort of worth it.
Well, not only that, the main publishers, I mean, the largest publishers, and I'm sure probably some of the smaller ones as well, are not that keen on dealing directly with authors because they depend on the agent to do expectations management. So it's not that easy. Although perhaps what you mean is do it yourself as a self-publisher. But that's not that easy either.
Yeah, that's not easy at all. So in terms of what you cover, maybe talk about what you like to take on and sort of how it works in terms of the percentage of fiction to nonfiction or nonfiction to fiction.
I represent a lot more nonfiction than fiction. I read a lot more fiction than nonfiction. It's harder to sell fiction, although when it works, it's really fun. For example, a novel by a client of mine that came out years ago called The Tribes of Palos Verdes was made recently into a film starring Jennifer Garner. And so how fun was that to go to the premiere and everything? The categories I like are, I tend towards literary fiction. I am not that keen on commercial women's fiction. I like voice and character-driven mysteries. I really like working with journalists on narrative nonfiction. I love working with chefs, actually, because they are so passionate about what they do. And I also do a fair number of research-based psychology and self-help books. And some gift books as well, illustrated books, books on gardening, stuff like that.
What do you absolutely not consider?
I do not like political screeds. I don't handle much genre fiction except for mysteries and thrillers. So I would not be the right person for a romance or a Western. I'm not that keen on hearing from people who have access to grind. I think memoirs, I actually like narrative nonfiction better than memoir, and let me explain what I mean by that. Narrative nonfiction is nonfiction with a storyline and may have a personal element, but is not necessarily all about you. I think memoirs are really tough, although I just read Tara Westover's Educated and thought it was amazing. But in general, I am more drawn to narrative nonfiction.
In terms of memoir, because I think there's still a ton of writers writing memoir, do they need to have something else going on? I mean, there's a few memoirs that have come out that, I don't know, that I would call them hybrid, but they're more narrative in terms of what they put forth in terms of information. I guess Educated was a little bit like that, a little bit, but... You know, I'm thinking of Bernadette Murphy's Harley memoir.
Yes, yes.
Which, you know, there was a lot of information in it as well as her own personal story. What about that?
To me, that is a hybrid, but since it does have the narrative nonfiction element as well, I think that kind of book is much more attractive to me and I think can also be more viable in the marketplace because it has an angle. I do see a fair number of submissions where there is a kind of therapeutic element to what somebody is trying to do, and that doesn't always work. I think writing can be therapeutic, but that's not the primary goal. It really has more to do with your relationship with the reader than it does with your relationship with your own memories and so forth. And that element can be missing.
Sure. Well, you know, getting back to when we, you know, started out a few minutes ago, thinking about maybe what's changed since you came on last, I was thinking that self-publishing has taken off in a grand way, and I am curious how that's impacted what you do as an agent. I mean, my gosh, you know, there are so many self-published books, and some are good, and most seem to be riding the line of, writing some line. I'm not sure what that line is, but there's so many, and I wonder how that impacts you.
I think that it adds to the noise. I think noise in our culture is kind of a big problem with the internet and social media and all that kind of thing, which is, you know, many claims on our attention. It hasn't actually affected my process that much. I don't tend to work with previously self-published authors. In other words, I don't tend to take on self-published books and then try to get them to a larger audience. I think the one of the biggest changes I've seen is just the number of books that come out every year, and self-publishing has something to do with that.
Do you think publishers pay more attention to agented submissions now that there are so many books self-published?
Definitely. No question.
And what about self-published books that do well? I mean, I'm not even really sure what do well means. I don't know if it means, you know, you sell 5,000 books, 10,000 books. But how many books might someone have to sell to actually get your interest?
I would say 20 or 30,000 with some evidence of momentum and interesting things happening that might be attention in prominent places, or it might mean you have a ton of followers on Instagram or whatever, something that another publisher, not you as the self-publisher, could use as leverage. It, for some reason, it rarely interests me. That's not where I get excited, is it, you know, in the idea of launching or relaunching somebody who has self-published. I like starting from scratch. I like being able to have an influence from you know, the earliest moments.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned social media, and I'm also curious about when somebody queries you, when a writer queries you, do you check them out on social media? Do you want to see how many followers they have? Is that important to you? Do you think that's a way to sell books, and so you want them to have a lot of Instagram followers or a lot of followers on Twitter?
You know, it depends. It depends on the project. It's not really possible for everybody to have a lot of followers, and I don't think publishers expect that anymore. They want a platform, but platforms come in many forms. So there's not one right way. What I'm looking for is some sense that the author might be able to reach readers, and that they're not operating in a vacuum. And obviously, this is more important for nonfiction than it is for fiction, because fiction is going to rise or fall on the strength of the writing and the story.
Which is why when you respond to a query letter, somebody's written a novel, you want to see the whole book or the whole memoir as opposed to a book proposal for a nonfiction book.
Yes. I might actually start with 50 pages or something for narrative nonfiction or fiction. Maybe not the whole novel. But yes, you want to see a big chunk of it. And so, again, I'm sometimes approached by people who have an idea they want to know what I think of. And ideas are cheap, in a sense, you know? So it's really all in the execution, at least in book publishing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and you have a reader, and I'm wondering, what is the role of a reader? And does she see every single thing that comes in? And does she know your taste so well that she's not going to make a mistake? She's going to send things to you that she knows you will want to see, and she's going to say no to other projects that she knows are just not for you.
I generally try to impress on my readers that they should be cautious, and if they're not sure, they should run something by me. Things come into me in a number of ways. One is through my website and the link there, and that's what Rose looks at. But then other things come into me directly through referral, and I may then send it to her for a first read. The projects that are referred tend to have a higher chance of working, often because it's a writer trying to encourage a debut writer, say. So the person approaching me is already in a network. I did once, in the olden days when a reader used to work on my dining room table looking through things, I did once come in on her and she was about to put back a project into an envelope and send it off. and it was something, and I grabbed it out of her hands and then ended up selling it. So that is what has made me impress on readers to be very cautious and not let their own taste dominate, but just try to get a sense of my taste. But I am also interested in their taste, because why not? They're, you know, generally the people reading for me are very smart and attuned to literature and so forth. I find my reader invaluable. I adore her.
Well, you know, you mentioned referrals and that they kind of occupy a higher rung on the ladder. And so what about meeting writers other ways? I mean, at conferences, is that another point for on the part of the writer that they've met you, that they can say, I met you at Squaw Valley, or I met you at Breadloaf, or whatever?
Definitely. It's very helpful to meet face-to-face. It doesn't guarantee anything. The work still has to be the thing, you know, that has an impact. But it is helpful to meet face-to-face. And I think conferences tend to be good. Some are better than others. The more they focus on the craft, the better, I think.
Mm-hmm. And what about the slush pile? You said some things just come in, you know, without referrals, they just come in. I mean, how often does it happen, do you think, that you find something that way that you end up taking on?
It happens rarely, but it does happen. And that's true for most agents, I would say. And there's much more urgency. This is another way that things have changed. With most people preferring email submissions, things happen very fast. So if something is good, it is likely to be snapped up quickly, and you can't just sit around and let things pile up. You have to respond if you're interested. So I think that gives authors more leverage, authors with good material.
Well, speaking of letting things sit around or responding to a writer right away, so is that something like often you send something to an agent and they say, you know, we get back to you within, I don't know, 2 months, 3 months, whatever it is. Can you judge how they like what you've done by how soon they get back to you? I mean, if you haven't heard from an agent in a couple of months, should you assume that they've already taken a look at your stuff and they, you know, kind of stinks, or it's just not for them and they're just waiting to get back to you? I mean, can you read between the lines in any way?
You know, I don't think it actually pays to read between the lines, because often you are tempted to think the worst.
Mm-hmm.
I think agents talk about that among themselves, too. I don't tend to assume anything with editors, either. I generally like to check back. And I think that authors can do that as well. You know, it helps if you have an offer of representation and you can say, you know, but I'd still love to hear from you. And then, you know, that will hurry us up, and we will take a look, and we will take a look quickly, because we don't want to hold you up if you have an offer of representation. It's a big universe. If you're not hearing from somebody, you should move on. One way, this is going to be our theme today, another way things have changed is that people don't always respond. I feel that used to be very, very rare in the publishing industry generally, even though everybody is dealing with so much. And I feel that now, you know, silence probably means no. But then you should just move on. You know, there's no harm in checking back. Have you had a chance to read X? And if you just continue to be ignored, it's generally that the agent is too busy to pay close attention to the stuff that's coming in over the transom.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I am talking with Betsy Amster. She's a literary agent in Los Angeles. There's been a question floating around the Authors Guild forum, and it has to do with books that a writer reissues after a book goes out of print from a traditional print publisher. Is that reissued book considered a new book or a reprint? And I ask because, again, this writer on the forum said he reissued a book, and while the original publication did very well, the reprint did not do well and has counted as a black mark on his record. So I'm trying to wade through all that and figure it out. What do you think?
know? Do you know anything more? Meaning, did somebody? Did he publish it himself?
Yeah, the first time it was a traditional print publisher.
And then he reissued it himself.
Right.
And do you know how he means black mark on his record?
I think because it didn't do well, he feels that now with...
Oh, that with the focus on
right,
track record.
Right.
I don't know. You know, I sometimes think that the most important thing... In fact, I always think that the most important thing is the quality of the work. So if the next work were absolutely outstanding and irresistible, I don't know that that would necessarily be held against him. It might be seen as a blunder, but I think many things are possible. I still have a sense of possibility. You know, I've been in publishing for a very long time. The one thing that hasn't gone away is the sense of possibility. So... I don't know. I mean, I don't think it pays to rush out and reissue things, mainly because it is rare for those to do well. It's hard. There are too many books out there. Mm-hmm. You know, the book sale declined. That means bookstores are going to be less likely to be interested in the reissue. I had an author who had a reissue, a very interesting kind of trajectory. Her name is Margaret Leslie Davis, and she's a popular historian, and she's written a lot of books on prominent Southern California figures like Mulholland. And she wrote a book called Mona Lisa in Camelot about the time that Jackie Kennedy brought the Mona Lisa over to the National Gallery in the Met. And DiCapo published it, part of Perseus, and it was excerpted in Vanity Fair. And, you know, over time, book sales declined. And we ended up reverting the rights, and the White House Historical Association made a new edition of the book with more photos to coincide with Jackie's 90th birthday, if I'm remembering correctly, and has just totally gone to town with it. But that was in a context,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it's very different. I mean, it is not uncommon for sales to decline, and usually that's the end of the book. But this one has had an amazing second life, but in a very special kind of context.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. How nice for her.
Yeah, it's really been great, and they've sent her on tour and everything. I think part of it is that their ecosystem is different. They're not depending on bookstores
right.
in the same way that publishers do. And that is handy.
Yeah. Well, has it changed in terms of, you know, what you do as an agent with small publishers? Because it used to be that, at least as far as I know, that agents went to larger publishers because there would be a larger advance and therefore they could actually make money for what they do instead of, you know, you get a small publisher who pays, I don't know, $5,000 even or less, 15% of that isn't very much. But these days, are small publishers seen as being more appealing to approach, or do you still kind of start with the, you know, major ones, and then kind of go down the list and go through the small publishers?
I think that agents tend to prioritize publishers by size, for sure. When you are working on commission, that's, you know, meaningful. That's a factor. So we will, I mean, generally you'll have kind of an A list and a B list and a C list, and you might be perfectly happy to end up with a smaller house. I think there are incredible smaller houses. Sometimes their marketing muscle is not as great, but then again, sometimes the larger houses drop the ball, you know, so there are no guarantees. I think that there is a feeling that the smaller houses have become more necessary. And, you know, that is good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like what I'm reading, too, about independent bookstores seem to be, you know, coming back
sort of
a little
on
bit.
The upswing. Yeah, you know? On the upswing.
That's a great thing to sell all these books. Anyway, so query letters. We have to talk about query letters because they are pretty much the port of entry between writers and agents. And so What do you see coming in? I mean, do the query letters you get often reflect the project or not? I mean, you know, it's hard to get tone in a query letter, I think, especially for a novel. And I don't know what you're paying attention to when you read a query letter. Are you paying attention to the writing? Are you paying attention to the story that the writer is trying to interest you in?
I'm paying attention to how businesslike it is, to tell you the truth. And I don't mean that in a dull way. I mean that I want the author to present themselves to me in a way where they're going to, you know, highlight their strengths. And where it's concise and kind of snappy. It is very difficult to tell from a one-paragraph summary of a book, you know, how good it is. With narrative material, either fiction or nonfiction, I always ask for the first three pages embedded in the email. And I will tend to zip through the letter. I want to know, you know, if you have credentials, if you have previous publication, that's great. Or, you're, you know, you're an academic with this, that, and the other kind of experience and vita. I want to know all those things, but then I'm going to look at the material. It, just as people do in airport bookstores when they're trying to figure out what to read, they will look at the first few pages. I want to be grabbed. I want to have the sense that you're in the driver's seat and that you're launching a story for the narrative material.
Yeah. And so when you then approach an editor, are you using any of that query letter and skewing it to your query to that editor?
Very little. Hardly ever. Hardly ever refer back to it.
Hmm.
No. I have something I call the parlor game with my authors because there's a lot of back and forth in it. And we work out the pitch that I'm going to use with editors. And, you know, it can take 10 rounds to get it right, and I will be very exacting. We generally come up with copy that is really irresistible, and I have been complimented on my pitch letters to editors. And that is because my writers are willing to cast aside modesty, although that's what is part of what takes all the rounds, and they're very clever. And I think that I am good at kind of pulling it out of them and being relentless. So therefore, we are a good team. But that's my process for arriving at the copy for my pitch.
But you also are a good writer, and that can be kind of rare in an agent, I think. I mean, you have writing skills, you have editing skills, and probably that contributes quite a bit to getting it right, you know.
Definitely that is part of it. It's kind of a 50-50 proposition, but often I really feel that my authors are brilliant, and they will sometimes, despite their modesty or despite the fact that this is going to proceed in rounds, come up with something so wonderful as we do this process. And that is really handy for me.
Do you find the same mistakes happening over and over again in query letters that you are sent?
Well, one of the biggest mistakes is approaching agents who don't handle the material that you're querying on. Another one is just being sloppy. You know, I don't know. Somehow people are not bringing the mindset that they would if they were trying to get a job. And that's when I say I'm looking for something businesslike or professional, that's what I'm looking for. It's just that best foot forward feeling.
Yeah. Well, back to fiction. Are there genres that are selling better than others? I mean, you know, it seems like literary fiction is harder than ever. And then online, on Amazon or wherever, you know, horror and erotica sell really well, but agents don't really handle that. And then with mystery and suspense, there's all these, all these groups that support each other. You know, there's Left Coast, there's Sisters in Crime, there's Mystery Writers of America, yet mysteries and suspense tend to not be reviewed very well. So what do you think? I mean, is there something that, is there a genre that really does continue to sell well? Or is there a wave with it? And sometimes it's literary fiction, sometimes it's mystery, sometimes it's this, sometimes
I actually think it's all of the above, because I think it's a giant tent. What I'm seeing on the best of lists is, you know, there's a lot of interest in very propulsive fiction, often a kind of woman in peril or unreliable narrator. I think Gone Girl was one of the original, you know, progenitors of that kind of book or that kind of unfolding of a story. And then there's also a lot of interest in voices from other cultures, a ton of interest in voices from other cultures, which is great. But honestly, I always think that it's not a good idea to think of, to try to factor in what's currently selling, because that can change, and it comes back to the quality of the material and how strong is it. How much does it hook the reader? It's handy to have, you know, it's handy to have some ammo and leverage. And one thing that you do in a query letter is you compare yourself to other writers, other successful writers, you know, the so-called comps. You know, and the more legitimate the comparison is, that's good. But I don't know. I think it can be that way lies madness to try to figure out what's selling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can figure it out pretty easily by looking at bestseller lists. But then if you try to reverse engineer something, you could end up in trouble.
And so often the same names come up over and over again on the bestseller list. You know, James Patterson is always there. Nora Roberts is always there. Balducci,
yes.
You know, the same writers who have such a track record and such readership.
But here's something really interesting. I was looking at Publisher's Lunch this morning, and I saw that the CFO at the News Corporation, i.e. HarperCollins, spoke at a media conference recently, and she said, "We've had tremendous success with some first-time authors who had some major hits."
Hmm.
That's why they were having a really good year.
Hmm.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, that is great.
Loved it. Yeah, I mean, so there's still, that's why I say it's all of the above.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like no sooner do you feel you've put your finger on a trend, then there can be some countervailing little bit of information.
Right. Well, what about hybrid publishing? We've talked a little bit about that via email. What do you think? I mean, are there viable sources or viable places to do this where, you know, you maybe are not getting an advance, but the publisher is going to put out your book and share royalties with you?
I think there are. I have an author currently who's working with She Writes, which is, I think, a really amazing publisher, tries very, very hard to educate their authors about what it takes to succeed in the marketplace. Behaves like a traditional publisher in the sense of bringing very high expectations to the work, to the packaging of the work. And so, you know, if you want to get your book out there and you are not succeeding with conventional publishers, I think it's worth looking into. There are various guidelines online, I was noticing, about what makes a hybrid publisher a good choice, and I think those would be worth researching, but it tends to boil down to they have the same expectations of quality as a larger house, and they don't take on everything that's submitted to them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. We have a few minutes left. I've been with Betsy Amster, a literary agent in Los Angeles, and if you are just tuning in, you can hear this show if you go to iTunes, subscribe to Writers on Writing, and in a few days, I will podcast this show so you can hear it from the start. Before we end, though, maybe a few words about, you know, there's so much information these days that you can find online on agents. And so when a writer actually garners interest from an agent, what might be important for that writer to ask or learn from the agent if they've already kind of, they've seen, you know, what deals that the agent has maybe done and what they want, and, you know, you can find so much. So what would you want to know? What more would you want to know?
asking about the agent's process in a very nice and conversational and non-consumer reports way is the way to go. And because what you want to make sure of is that the agent will send you rejection emails and that they will share with you what their strategy is before they go out with the book. So are they working from an A list, a B list, a C list? How many publishers do they tend to go to before they give up? The process needs to be transparent, sometimes isn't, and then that can put you in an awkward position. You're trying to get a new agent because you've decided you're not satisfied with that agent who isn't keeping you posted, but you can't find out where your material has been, and then the prospective new agent doesn't want to be, sort of sandbagged in the marketplace, finding out that they're submitting to a place that has already turned it down. So transparency is super important. Plus, I mean, it's the whole relationship has to be, I think, has to turn on transparency and genuine communication. For example, I don't think you should be afraid of your agent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but it is a business relationship, too. And so, you know, I mean, I talk to people who say, you know, I want an agent who is a good friend. And, if an agent doesn't give you their home number, you should not go with that agent. There's such...
Yikes. That would be bad.
There's conflicting info, you know, in terms of what you should expect.
And it is a business relationship. It can evolve into a friendship, but it has to evolve. It doesn't start out that way.
Right.
But it is one... I mean, the agent has to have respect for the incredible effort that the author has put into their work. And has to communicate that not only to editors, but to the writer himself or herself. So it has to be a relationship of respect in both ways, with the author understanding that the agent has a better knowledge of the publishing industry, of course, having operated within it for years. So it's sort of a relationship of mutual regard, I would say.
Mm. And you did mention Publisher's Lunch, and maybe before we go, talk about sort of areas of research that writers should really know about. I mean, if you want to really learn about the agent, that before you query that agent, you know, I mean, Publisher's Lunch is one place, and worth $25 a month, I think, to find that information. Anything else?
Well, I think it pays to look at directories, and Publisher's Lunch maintains their agent pages. Writer's Digest also does a really good job with their agent information. And what you should do is draw up a list of, I mean, you might have your own A list, B list, C list of agents that you want to go to. But start out with the directories to draw up that list and then go to the agent websites. And you can find out a lot about the agent from the website, not only the sales that they've made, but sort of how they present themselves. You know, how professional is the website, et cetera. You know, how easy it is to use. Are the submission guidelines clear? That's where you're going to get the very nuanced submission guidelines and what the agent doesn't want to handle.
Hmm. Well, as usual, you have been most informative, and I appreciate you coming back on, Betsy.
It is a real pleasure. Thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome. Thank you. That was Betsy Amster. Her agency is Betsy Amster Literary Enterprises in Los Angeles, and you can easily find her online. You can Google her, find her website. She's one of the best, and I can't say enough about Betsy. We are at the end of our time. If you just tuned in again, go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, and you will receive this podcast when it is podcast in a few days. And there's just a ton of other stuff on there. And if you would be so kind as to leave us a review, that will help others find the show on iTunes. That's all. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I thank you for listening, and have a great week.